David Simon is best known as the creator of TV's The Wire, the HBO show that chronicled the story of Baltimore's police department and its gangs. Simon, a former reporter for the Baltimore Sun, is also known for his NBC police procedural Homicide: Life on the Streets. The show was based on his book Homicide: A Year on the Killing Streets, which described the time he spent with officers in the Baltimore Police Department's homicide unit. Last night he spoke at Williams College and presented a lecture titled The Audacity of Despair, which also happens to be the name of his blog, a self-described collection of prose, links, and occasional venting from David Simon. Simon was the first speaker in the Class of 71 at Public Affairs Forum on Inequality. He sat down with me about an hour before his lecture to discuss everything from covering issues on the war on drugs, activism, to democracy, and of course, television. David Simon, thank you very much for taking the time out to talk with us.
Thanks for having me.
When you do events like this, especially on college campuses, what do you like to talk about?
I mean, the one thing that has probably been my predominant theme for about a decade, certainly in The Wire it was a theme, is to try to assert against the drug war, drug prohibition, as being an incredible disaster for the country and for American cities in particular. So I tend to try to get near young, impressionable minds and urge them to have nothing to do with the drug war. I think if I get that one done, I've done a little something.
I want to get to that and the drug war and what is inherently wrong with it. Was there ever a point where we had that balance, that equation right?
No. No, the drug war has always been, I think, a means of social control, and it's always been targeted against fear of the other. If you go back to its origins, I mean, if you go back all the way to the turn of the century and into the late 19th century, the first moments of drug fear, of what became the basis, policing of dangerous drugs, has to do with, like, the fear of the yellow horde on the West Coast, the opium dens of the dreaded Chinese. It's always been linked to some fear of the immigrant other or the racial other. And if you look at the history of drug prohibition, it's never come from an organic logic that says by treating this as a criminal dynamic rather than a health problem, we can achieve anything. They've never sold that with any credible empiricism because it never does. It never fixes anything. It just makes for a lot of people in a lot of prisons. And at this point, you know, we never lost our mind quite as we did in the 1990s, but we did lose our minds, and we filled prison after prison after prison with nonviolent offenders.
So you get those nonviolent offenders off the street, and not only that, but you put them in a place that you call a correctional facility. So the whole thing is flawed.
It's flawed for a variety of reasons. First of all, I'm not sure a democracy can stand being the jailingest society on the history of humankind. We are that. We jail more of our population than any other country on the face of the earth. And I mean, the possible exception might be North Korea, and only because we don't know the extent of their prison population. But we jail actually more people, not per capita, more people than China. Now, China's working with billions. You know, we're working with 350 million. And somehow we find a way to build prisons for more of our people by raw number than China. Never mind per capita. We're off the charts. This is barbaric. And the level of violence that can be attributed to the people we're putting in jail. In my career as a reporter, when I started, the rate of violence in the federal system, for example, which is admittedly the federal system doesn't have like crimes like murder for the most part, unless it's a unique violation. You know, I mean, there should be a lot of people who are there for white-collar stuff or, you know, other things. But it has bank robbery. It has a lot of gun crime. But basically, it was about 34% of the people in federal prisons. When I started as a reporter in the early 80s, were in there for violent offenses. When I left as a reporter in the mid-90s, and it's gotten no better since then, it was about 7%. So we went from 34% violent offender in our top-tier prison system to about 7%. Not only did we waste treasure on that, but think about all the families that were destroyed by, plus the length of sentences, the elimination of parole, three-time loser laws. We're sending people away for longer and longer and longer, destroying families, destroying communities. And nowhere did the purity level of cocaine or heroin go down. It didn't do any good. You know, when I started as a police reporter, there were maybe 20 open-air drug markets in Baltimore, most of them in the high-rise projects or the low-rise projects. When I left, after jailing the planet just about, there were about 120 corners like that. It did nothing. It achieved nothing. The weirdest thing is counterintuitive. It taught the police department how not to police, because they got really good at making cheap drug arrests and making their stats that way, and everyone got promoted and everyone got paid in court for grabbing a guy with a bag of dope or a vial of cocaine. And nobody taught anybody else over a couple generations in the department how to do police work. So the clearance rate in places like Baltimore and Chicago or South Central LA, the clearance rate for like murder went from being 70-80% in the early 1980s to being about 30% now. We don't solve crimes anymore because that would require police work. And the drug war is not police work.
What is the alternative in your mind as to, you mentioned it being a public health crisis and problem. So how do we address it at that level? Because it also, public health, but mental health obviously enters into this as well.
And poverty. Poverty enters into it. I mean, I'm not sure that anybody can make a credible argument to a 14-year-old kid coming up in places in South Chicago or North Philadelphia or West Baltimore that it's an irrational decision to go down on the corner and raise up as a lookout or run a ground stash for some older drug dealer when that's the only industry you've ever known in your neighborhood who's ever been hiring. The factories are all closed. The jobs that used to be an evident transport to American society, for people who had a high school degree, or maybe not even that, they don't exist anymore. Now the job is at a computer screen somewhere far away from you, and it requires a level of training that wasn't ever credible as an outcome within the public education system that you knew. And there's this one factory still hiring, and it's up on the corner, and it hired your older brother, and it hired your cousin, and it hired your father. The level of hopelessness is such that I'm not sure you can argue with that kid. The kids that we saw in West Baltimore when we did the corner and we followed them for a year, they were being rigorously trained for the one factory that was still open. You know, never mind mental health, poverty, the fact that there are these two Americas, and in one of them, there are viable alternatives to find your way through and become connected economically, socioeconomically to the society. And in the other one, there isn't. And I live in a city that is rigorously divided between those two Americas. So the people in the one America, you try to police into the face of that, you might as well be policing Soweto or Gaza. You're up against the entire neighborhood because everybody looks upon, it's like trying to police Birmingham in 1960 and saying, you can't work in the steel mills. The steel mills are illegal. Don't make steel. You know, it sounds insane, but to tell a kid in Baltimore in 2005 or 2015, don't go down to the corner, don't make that money. We have some other place, some other plan for you. Yeah, what other place? What other plan? Really? We can't even figure out summer jobs program. So on some level, the drug trade as an industry proved itself to be rational, even as it destroyed human beings, even as it destroyed neighborhoods, it proved to be rational on a day-to-day basis, on an economic basis. And we have to upend that, and that's kind of epic. That would be epic.
When you consider what happened most recently in Baltimore, and we're talking about nationwide headlines with Freddie Gray, is there anything that surprised you about that that was different than what you had seen coming down the pike from your years working the streets of that city? Is it safe to say even that maybe if there was a surprise, it was that it maybe doesn't happen more often?
I think it's happened, and it's happened routinely. By the way, I got to be very careful about Freddie Gray, because Freddie Gray is not the optimum case of police violence. There are many more cases that I think are more profoundly disturbing. And there's a lot of tragedy in Freddie Gray, including, I think there's a real negligence case that happened in terms of him being in the back of that wagon and being unattended for 45 minutes. There's a negligence case. I think the case was overcharged as manslaughter, or and certainly as second-degree murder. I thought that was an overreaction on the part of a very wounded city and its leadership in the wake of the disturbances. But having said that, Garland in Staten Island or Scott in Carolina, we've been witness to a lot of police violence that is absolutely without question an affront to Black lives. I don't think there was anything in my head that suggested it wasn't happening, even when I was a police reporter. The difference between now and then is simply this, and you know, I realize we're doing radio, I'm holding up my smartphone with the camera in it. As a police reporter, I probably covered 100 police shootings. I haven't taken a careful count, but I would guess that probably 70 of them at least, I had no question about. They were, you know, we live in a heavily armed society. There's a lot of guns on the street. There's a lot of violence. It's kind of hard to ask anybody to police anywhere in an American city, you know, with this level of gun saturation, and do so unarmed, or do so in a circumstance where you're never going to use your weapon. Although many police go their whole careers without using their weapon, you know, there are certain posts where it's going to happen. It's going to happen to somebody at some moment. So I guess what I'm saying is I covered a lot of honorable police shootings. They were not any less tragic than many dishonorable ones. People died. People were wounded. But I covered a lot of police shootings that were legitimate. And then I covered, I would say, maybe 25% of them. I had no idea. I don't know what happened, because it's what a police could write in his report and what a guy might claim, but it was basically one guy's word against another, and there was no other evidentiary logic with which you could judge it. And one of those guys knows how to write a police report. He knows how to testify in front of a grand jury, and one of them doesn't. And one of them might have no criminal history, and one of them might have an extensive criminal history. So, and even if there were a couple of witnesses, if they were from the milieu of the drug corner or wherever the shooting happened and they had criminal histories, the credibility was such that a prosecutor could knock it down. So there were a lot of shootings where, as a reporter, it was like, you know, I have no consistency between the narrative that the police are telling me and the guy shot is, or the witnesses are saying. So often the guy shot is dead. He can't tell me anything. And that case would fly. And you would always be left with, wondering what was legit. And then there were 5% of the cases where there were a lot of witnesses and the police really did something wrong. And in those cases, there were controversies, and you know, I covered some of those. But what's happened with the cell phone is that a lot of the cases that were in that 25% bracket of we don't know, now suddenly there's first-generation evidence from just regular folk pointing their cameras. And for police, that's a whole new world. And they're having a hard time adapting to the fact that sometimes the lies and the disconnects and the falsity that used to protect them in the case of a bad shooting is no longer there, or is now confronted by an alternative reality.
In your work and the dramatization of that, of what is happening on the streets with the police, what do you see your role in addressing these issues through that particular creative medium?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't have that much role right now. The last project I did was about public housing policy, and the one before that was about culture, and the one right now is about the sex trade and misogyny. So, you know, a lot of what I worked on with regard to The Wire or The Corner is somewhat distant from me. So I'm not sure I have a specific role, other than that it's obviously having spent 13 years as a police reporter and having worked on stuff after that in a dramatic fashion, I'm interested in this stuff. I live in Baltimore. I'm vested in it as a citizen, and I watch and I'm attended to it. And I have a high regard for very good police work. I saw some of it done in Baltimore. And I have a very low regard for the drug war, which I think is antithetical to good police work. So I'm very interested in the issue, and I like arguing. I've always loved arguing. It's not personal. I see no negative connotation in arguing with people, as long as the rhetoric is clean. So I get involved in discussions of it, but I'm not sure. I mean, what role do I have? I think maybe I'm like just a gadfly at this point. I mean, as a dramatist, I can't really say that I'm working on anything right now that goes to the heart of this. I mean, I'm working on a miniseries, but it's about the civil rights movement in the 60s and into 68. Does that have something to do, you know, does race have a fundamental import when it comes to these issues? Absolutely. So, I mean, maybe I'm knocking around the fringe of it, but I'm not. It's hard to suggest that I'm at the heart. I mean, I'm in the middle of some sort of creative maelstrom over it.
Which just makes me wonder, would The Wire be different now, given the cell phone that we're pointing to?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think if you look at The Wire, the impulse towards brutality and towards non-accountability on the part of the police department is embedded in the piece. I mean, I don't think you have to go 2.5 episodes before one of the police officers resorts to an unnecessary brutality and blinds a kid in one eye in the projects, and his lieutenant explains to him how to lie about it to the internal investigators so that it won't go further than the grand jury. That happened, I think, in episode 3 of a 60-episode show, and we revisited the idea of brutality. One police beat up a school teacher in a car. One other guy broke the fingers of a 12-year-old after he stole a car. We routinely return to the idea of the drug war being this moral disconnect for some officers. But what we didn't have was the idea of being confronted by the fact that your lies might now be, that the things that you do to protect officers who've overreached or who've made mistakes or who have been willfully abusive, your ability to damage control that stuff is now much more vulnerable because of this technology. We would certainly show that because the smart camera, the smartphone with its camera, has been a revolution.
David Simon is a former reporter for the Baltimore Sun, also known for his NBC police procedural Homicide, and of course HBO's Wire and Treme. He spoke at Williams College last night. David Simon, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for taking the time out.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.